This is The Edge with your hosts, Jonathan Von Tobel.
Very torn, Jonathan Von Tobel, here on The Edge. Last hour, by the way, Wes Reynolds is going to be with us bottom of this hour. It's also the championship coming up in golf. We will get his thoughts on that out in California. So I said I was in. Jets catching 14 against the Buffalo Bills. Might not be in anymore, because they're catching 21 week 8 against the Kansas City Chiefs. Look ahead line posted up at Superbook by the guys over there at the Westgate. Jets catching 21 on the road against the Kansas City Chiefs. Look ahead line week 8. Interesting. See, I'm telling you, like, when people say, by the way, when people say that this, like Team A or whatever is going to go 0-16 against the spread, this is why it's, you don't say it's impossible, but why it's extremely hard to go 0-16 against the number. The number is just going to get so big that at one point they are going to cover just because of that. Now, is that going to come in the next few weeks where they're catching 13, potentially 14 by the time we get to kickoff against the Buffalo Bills this week? And then, of course, week 8 at the Chiefs. We'll see. But again, now we're looking at a total of, and this is the way you calculate this, but it sounds more dramatic this way. The Jets catching a total of potentially 35 points over the next 2 weeks. Can you imagine if they failed to cover both of those games?
Good spin on that. That does sound a lot better.
It sounds so much better, right? Yeah. Sounds so much better. And you want to bet a money line. Good luck with that.
Hey, I'll check out that Chiefs money line too. They might be on a streak by then after they roll through the Bills.
Just roll your money over. just roll the winnings over. Okay. We'll get back to football in a little bit. But let's take a look at the World Series. It's going to start tonight, 5:11 p.m. Pacific time. First pitch, Rays and Dodgers. Very excited for this matchup. Now, pitching matchup, Ty Glasnow, Clayton Kershaw will oppose one another. Interesting pitching matchup because, of course, Clayton Kershaw, last time we saw him, Dave Roberts was like, that third time through the order, you can do it. Buck up, kid. Make it through. Ultimately, he did not make it through. Dodgers, though, $1.65 favorite here. I was going to say at home. They are the home team over at Arlington. Opening number here, and the total, by the way, 7.5, shaded to the under at -115. Open 165, got to 175-ish, depending on where you look for your numbers, back down to where we're sitting at right now. So, overall, I am of the belief that the Dodgers are going to win this first game, I think. Ty Glasnow has had kind of an up-and-down postseason. Ty Glasnow has had kind of an up-and-down year. Last time we saw him against the Astros, Rays ended up losing that game 4-3. He went 6 innings, gave up 8 hits, walked 2, 4 earned runs, got taken deep twice, only struck out 5. He also had that start, and the Rays eventually won this game. But he also had that start against the Yankees back on October 6th, in which he went 5 innings, gave up 3 hits, got taken deep twice as well. And that one, walked 3, ended up striking out 10, but gave up 4 earned runs there. Sandwiched in there was a really short outing, 37 pitches, 2 1/3 against the Yankees in game 5 of their divisional series. That's the troubling thing here about Glasnow right now, is in the postseason, he has been getting torched when it comes to the home runs. Over 4 starts in 19 and a third innings pitched, he has given up 6 home runs, right? 3 of the 4 starts, he's given up 2 earned runs in each of those. And of course, again, the game 5, he's only out there for 2 1/3, not enough time to get torched. But in that short time, he still walked 2 guys. I just don't think Glasnow at this point is in a spot that I'm willing to back and have faith in him, right? And, like, that's part of the issue, too. Like, I'm actually, this is where I'm torn a little bit here, because I am of the belief that overall in the series, if we're looking at, like, a series price and where we're at with how the Rays are being respected in the market, at least in terms of the Dodgers being, like, -200 and a series price. Remember, it opened, like, -215, -220 in some spots. Like, if it was that high in terms of the series price, I think overall the Rays are a better team than that series price indicates. Having said that, though, I do believe they're going to lose this game here today because of the way that Glasnow has been pitching. So I might wait here and see after game 1 what this adjustment is and come in on the Tampa Bay Rays after game 1. But it's really all about Glasnow and the way he's been pitching. And by the way, the updated series price, too, -215, -210 still, +185. So, like, while I do believe that the implied probability is a little bit higher for the Rays in terms of the overall series, I do think there's going to be a better series price available, and I think they'll be pretty live going forward. And the other part is how Roberts manages Kershaw in this series and in this game. Are you going to leave him out there past the fifth inning, past the third time through the order, which we have seen has been the issue for him? Because, of course, those of you who remember, He was actually pitching extremely well in that game against the Braves before it all blew up in his face. He goes 5 innings, 7 hits, 4 earned runs, 1 homer. Couldn't find the strike zone in that 5th inning. It just didn't go well for him. But overall, he had held them down until they got to that point. The only blemish was a solo home run to Marcell Ozuna before he gives up, you know, back-to-back doubles and the game starts to get away from them. So strongly into the Dodgers in game one, $1.65. It's going to be something I'll stay away from a price perspective, a little too high, but I do think the Dodgers will win game one, and then I'll see. I believe that the Rays are pretty live in the series. I just don't want to take 185 in a game, or excuse me, in a series, which I believe the team is going to lose game one, and you'll get well over 2-1 if that is the case going forward. So total 7.5, not sure what to do with that. I mean, look, if what we've seen from Glasnow holds true, 7.5 does seem a little low considering what this Dodgers lineup can do when they're on. And that's the other part of the equation, right? This has been an inconsistent lineup for the most part in the postseason. As for World Series MVP, now, obviously a lot of options for you. And I don't really love betting, you know, World Series MVPs and just like MVPs in general, over the 7-game series, because you have no idea who's going to step up over the course of a 7-game series. Obviously, a guy like Clayton Kershaw is in a spot in which he could win World Series MVP because, of course, he is, of course, starting in game one. And we should note that the World Series is formatted normally, like we're used to seeing. It's not going to be like the first few rounds where we have seen games every single day going forward. This is going to be a normal series so that you can have Kershaw potentially start 3 games for the Los Angeles Dodgers should they need him, right? A guy like Walker Buehler at 12-1, is he going to get enough action and enough run to be in the contention for World Series MVP? I'm kind of surprised that Seager's as low as he is, considering how well he has played up to this point, right? Sitting at 12-1 right now, that would probably be in the range. I'm actually really surprised that he's in double digits, considering the way he's swinging the bat, Corey Seager at this point. So I didn't really have anything strong there. But again, I'll take the Rays after game one if they do indeed lose, because I do think they're pretty live. I feel like in game one, the Dodgers have a better matchup here that's going to work out for them. So then we move on. National Football League. Wanted to throw a couple more games at you as we go through the slate, of course, the Sunday games, and work our way around in terms of analysis. So let's start with Carolina and New Orleans, because I am really, really interested in this Carolina team from a, you know me, numbers perspective and what we have seen from them up to this point. Saints open up as an 8-point favorite. We're looking at 7.5 across the market with a total of 51. Carolina has been much better statistically defensively over these last 4 games. But how much do you buy in that, right? That's the question you have to ask yourself up to this point. Some of the numbers for Carolina over the last 4 games: 19 points per game, 5.16 yards per play, 33.89 yards per drive, 7 forced turnovers over this 4-game run. They're 3-1 straight up and against the spread. However, over these 4 games, they have played the Chargers, the Cardinals, the Falcons, and the Bears. The best offense among them, those 4 opponents, is 20th in overall offensive efficiency, according to Football Outsiders. So while your defense has gotten much better over the last 4 weeks, and it's a defense, I wouldn't say all of us, I hate when people do that. I think that a large number of people, including myself, expected to be subpar considering the amount of young bodies that we're going to be playing, because, you know, they spend all 7 picks in their draft on rookies, and you want to break these guys in over a season where you don't know what you're going to do in terms of competing for a Super Bowl. And it showed through the first 2 weeks. Showed against the Raiders in week one, against the Buccaneers in week two. But it's been a surprise how good it's been over these last 4 weeks. But again, when you're taking in 20 and lower offenses, your defense should probably improve from a statistical standpoint. And it has, right? New Orleans only ranks 16th in offensive efficiency after week 5. So again, you're getting another bottom half of the league, bottom half of the league offense coming in to take you on, or I guess you're going in because you're playing in New Orleans. Here's the thing, though, that worries you a little bit about New Orleans offensively. Andres Pete, Ryan Ramczyk, Jared Cook all returned Monday Night Football against the Chargers. They're all fully healthy after a bye week and ready to go. Michael Thomas should be back as well. Ty Montgomery looks like he's going to be on the field for them as well. And people are like, Ty Montgomery, who cares about that? By all indications, the Saints really liked what he brought to the table, and they think that he could be a valid weapon for them, like a third, you know, tertiary piece for him, but something still that makes their offense just that much stronger. So you had the offensive line get healthier. You had Jared Cook pop up in that Monday night game and catch a touchdown. They look like they're going to be better. And Thomas back on the field. That's going to be massive. Talking about the Saints and the Panthers, guys. But we're looking at it from Carolina's perspective, too. The Panthers, if you're looking at this a couple of times here, right, their offense is really passive, man. We're talking about an offense that 4.9 yards per play, 27.5 yards per drive, 3 turnovers, 2 interceptions, and a fumble against the Chicago Bears, 3 of 13 on third down, 1 of 3 in the red zone. It's the 8th overall offense in terms of efficiency, but when they took on a top 5 unit in defense, it completely shut down on Sunday. And here's the other part about the Panthers, and this really bothered me when I was watching some of their games, and I'm like, you know, for a team that's 8th in offensive efficiency, right, the points per game total really isn't there for them. Why is that? And then you realize that Matt Rhule and the Panthers are like insanely, insanely passive when they get in the red zone. Right now, they're 28th in red zone efficiency, 47.83% in terms of converting red zone possessions into touchdowns. They need to get more aggressive because not only are you 28th in red zone efficiency, but it's not about, right, overall failing when you get to the 20-yard line. Think about that Chicago Bears game. They kicked 2 field goals inside the 5-yard line against the Chicago Bears, right? Joey Sly, their kicker, leads the league in field goal attempts from 20 to 29 yards. He's got 8. Next closest guy has 5. Like, Matt Rhule, for some reason, loves his short yardage field goals when he gets within the red zone. And against a Saints team that is fully healthy and ready to go, coming off of a bye week, and Heumann says this all the time, right? You don't want to be a hot team going into the bye week. The Saints were not a hot team going into the bye week, so maybe the bye week does them good. So overall, Saints are going to be one side, at least in terms of when it comes to, you know, I've been using these 2-team teasers to kind of build a bankroll. Saints are going to be on one side of it because I do think teasing this down to 1.5 here against the Panthers team that I think offensively has shown some issues, especially once they get into the red zone, and a defense that could be fool's gold after taking down some subpar offenses over the last 4 weeks, and a Saints offense that is getting healthy, I think New Orleans is going to be pretty live at home against the Carolina Panthers. Now, also up, and we've talked about this a couple of times, Buffalo, 10.5, total of 48 originally against the New York Jets. But the adjustment now up to 13, and Chris Andrews said this earlier on this show in the first hour, right, that he thinks here at the South Point, at least, we're going to see the full 14 for the Buffalo Bills in this spot against the New York Jets. And if it gets to the full 14, I'm in. And I'm going to state this case one last time that I did when I was talking to Chris Andrews. The Buffalo Bills, do you use the old line? Was it Dennis Green? The Buffalo Bills are who we thought they were. It's just that they were getting away with certain things. The first 3 games of the season, Josh Allen had a fumble problem. He fumbled and lost 3 straight games. He had lost a fumble in those games. The Los Angeles Rams game, in which they had a 28-3 lead, but ultimately blow that, partly because of a defense that ranks in the bottom 20s in the National Football League. The other part is because of Josh Allen playing wildly, running out of the pocket, trying to extend plays, getting sacked and dragged down, getting called for penalties. Like, this is not something new that we've seen over the last 2 weeks. And now all of a sudden, you get back-to-back games, the Titans game, in which you give up over 40 points and defensively don't really have an answer for what the Titans were giving to you offensively, right? And your defense was really poor. Josh Allen in that game throwing 2 interceptions, 1 nowhere near a receiver, the first one being right off of his receiver's shoulder pads, but still off in terms of his target, causing that interception because of an inaccurate throw. Like, this has been Josh Allen. This has been the Buffalo Bills. Even go back to that Raiders game, too, by the way. There was a play to Stephon Diggs in which Stephon Diggs is wide open downfield. It's a touchdown for them, but he throws it off target and behind Diggs. Diggs has to correct himself and catch it, and what should have been a massive touchdown ends up being, I believe, about a 30 or 40-yard gain. These mistakes have been there if you've been watching the Buffalo Bills, right? It's just, again, when you play the Jets, the Dolphins, the Rams, again, a game you should have lost, the Raiders, who are in the bottom 20s in terms of defensive efficiency, you're going to be able to mask that up. But when you take on the Titans, who I could be eventually wrong on here because, right, they're still undefeated at this point, still operating at a top 10 level in terms of offensive and defensive efficiency, or excuse me, not defensive, offensive efficiency. Like, I'm willing to admit that maybe I'm wrong on the Tennessee Titans. Maybe. We'll see. Might get burned by them again because I think I'm going to be betting on the Steelers again one more time. But regardless, don't be like, I would just say, go back and look at those games if you can, and look at those box scores and realize what the Bills were doing through the first 4 games. And don't be all in on maybe thinking that they're going to be blowing out this Jets team. And I get it. The Jets are insanely bad. And the other part of this analysis, too, is that reading a report coming out of New York that there's nothing official, but that the door is slightly open that you're going to get Sam Darnold back on the field. I don't know about you, but watching Joe Flacco scramble around for what was eventually, I think it was a 28 or 38 yard loss on a sack, think Sam Darnold's going to be a little bit better. Jacob says, yes, sir, as he gets ready to back the New York Jets, regardless of who their quarterback is going to be. Very excited. But regardless, again, all this being said, It's just a buy low spot for the New York Jets. And if I'm going to catch a full 14 with them, I think I'm going to be in at this point looking at that. Some really quickly, too, as we're going to get ready to, and we're going to take a look at the AFC East, the NFC East as a division overall. We should note that there's been a couple of line moves. New England Patriots down to a 2.5-point favorite at home against the San Francisco 49ers. Chiefs up to a 9.5-point favorite. That Bucks and Raiders game. Raiders now catching 3. Remember, that look-ahead was pick. And again, we'll get to analysis on all of these throughout the week. And then finally, the Chicago Bears come off the 6 across the board. Rams right now, 5.5-point favorite Monday night with a total of 46 against the Chicago Bears. And just as I say that, we should note we had a full slate of college football this coming weekend. Breaking news that nobody cares about. One game has been canceled. New Mexico, Colorado State. Mountain West has declared the game a no contest. No plan to reschedule the game, according to some breaking news there. So one game at least off the board for college football. It's a big number for Colorado State. Steve Dazio had a lot of guys coming back, but New Mexico, man, he's got this good running back, former UCLA commit. Kind of weird that they got him. Anyway, this Mountain West football nerddom. When we come back, NFC East Division odds, we'll take a look at that overall. We'll get back to football too. College football, Southeastern Conference, and give you some updated news if it comes. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. You instantly get a list of quality candidates from Indeed's resume database the moment you sponsor a job. Get started at Indeed.com/credit. So, minor breaking news out of the world of college football. If you're just joining us, New Mexico, Colorado State, taken off the board. It has been canceled. According to Jeff Grammer of the Albuquerque Journal, Colorado State, before this report, of course, was down, quote, 20s of players per practice. Some in new positions, of course, to make do. Air quality issues from the wildfires as well. New Mexico did not practice since last Wednesday. 9 players out with COVID. Workouts couldn't exceed groups of 5. And, of course, the official news today that the Lobos are not going to play Colorado State this weekend, announced today. And the game is postponed. It is canceled. It is a no contest. Will not count. And Commissioner of the Mountain West, actually a couple weeks ago when they announced the schedule, Craig Thompson even said when he was asked of media availability, have you made any room on the schedule for makeups? He said, no. And he didn't laugh like that, but he said, no, we're not going to make up contests and not everybody's going to play. It would be assumed, and this is where it gets interesting from a sports betting perspective, if you did indeed bet, right, the odds to win the Mountain West, whatever it is, that the standings are going to be decided by win percentage, considering I'm going to go out on a limb and say this is not the only Mountain West Conference game canceled. Up to this point. So something to keep an eye on. But again, New Mexico, Colorado State, not going to play this weekend. Colorado State was a pretty big favorite against the Lobos. With that, NFC East division odds. So let's take a look at this very quickly because this is absolutely incredible what's happening in this division. The Cowboys now fall to 2-4 on the season, +115 to win the division. The Eagles, who are essentially playing with Jacob and Triv at wide receiver and offensive line because they're so injured, which, by the way, might not be bad additions, although Jacob's a little svelte to be playing guard.
Who's playing offensive line and who's the receiver?
Oh, you, of course. Wait, you're playing offensive line.
Okay, yeah, that's fine.
Man, you're white. I mean, come on. Like, what are we doing?
Okay, I just want to make sure. I don't know if I need to bulk up.
Yes, you do, a little bit. You can be the Jeff Saturday of offensive linemen. Jeff Saturday was like 6 foot, but he packed on like all the weight.
I'll take that. Play center. Give me a week.
So Cowboys, Eagles, Washington, and New York. +115 to win the division for the Cowboys. Eagles +130. Washington 9-1. Giants 9-1 as well. I don't want any part of like Washington or New York. Like maybe they could stumble into contending for the division because of what's going on around them. Here's my case here. The Cowboys are failing because of the team that is constructed, right? And injuries have been a part of it. Their offensive line has been banged up. Tyron Smith done for the year. Lyle Collins done for the year. Part of the reason why their offense their offensive line has struggled, right? Dak Prescott, of course, done for the year with the ankle injury. Here's the thing, though, with Dak, right? He was there up until last week, and this team was still struggling. This Cowboys defense, there's no real injury issues to point to. In fact, last night they got healthier with Leighton Vander Esch back in the lineup, and they still gave up 38 points to a team that had their quarterback complete just 9 passes. So overall, the case here for the Cowboys is, to me, when I look at this, the Dallas Cowboys are in the spot that they are because they were an overvalued team that hired a head coach who is not good, who then hired a staff that is not good, right? Got an offensive coordinator that wasn't even his, to kind of have some continuity on that side of the ball. So why would I want to invest in the Cowboys to win this division when, by the way, on top of that, now they've lost their quarterback for the rest of the year, and I don't think there's a massive gap, but still a gap between Andy Dalton and Dak Prescott. But then I look at the Philadelphia Eagles, and the reason that the Eagles are in the spot that they're in, partly because of Carson Wentz and his poor play, which is kind of rounded out, and again, to give you the numbers, and we talked about this, but for the last 2 weeks, Carson Wentz, 6.28 yards per attempt, not very good, but 4 touchdowns, 2 interceptions. Eagles have gone from 21 points per game, 319 yards per game over the first 4 weeks of the season, to 28.5 points per game, 350 yards per game over the last 2 weeks against the Steelers and the Ravens. The Eagles are largely in this position because of injuries, right? And it's something that you would hope corrects itself eventually, and we haven't seen that for the Philadelphia Eagles up to this point. But I'd rather invest in an Eagles team that, when it comes to at least some of their issues, it's something that's kind of out of their control, right? And if they eventually get healthy, by comparison with the Cowboys and how bad they've been defensively, I'd rather be sitting on the Eagles plus 130 in a division that the winner could be like 6-10. I think it's the Eagles or pass here when you're looking at this. Again, we can consistently, like, calling Mike McCarthy Steve Kerr before the season started because he logged on to PFF one time. Like, things like this, like, this was an overvalued Cowboys team coming into the year, and it started to show itself, and injuries are starting to take place. The Eagles, not a lot of people had faith in this Eagles team. And in fact, if you remember the playoff props that we talked about before the season started, the Westgate had taken action on the Eagles not to make the postseason this year. But if they start to get healthy, like you said, I'd rather sit on plus 130 with the Philadelphia Eagles going forward than I would at plus 115 with the Cowboys team with their backup quarterback and a terrible defense. So, either way, like, a 6-win team is going to win this division, and it's going to be great that a 6-10 team is going to get a home playoff game by the time we get to the postseason. All right, SEC when we come back. Bo Nix and the Auburn Tigers kind of at the floor here when it comes to their value. Is it a spot where you want to come in and bet them? We can all use expert guidance with our weekly football betting, and now VSiN, the sports betting network, is providing all access to everything we offer for the rest of the football season for only $129. From now through February 8th, you'll get our weekly digital betting guides with power ratings, predicted scores, and consensus picks for the games each week, access to our 24/7 live video stream, and daily email updates featuring the best bets for every show, host, and guest, breaking news and advanced stats and game previews on VSiN.com, and our updated college football guide, including all the Big Ten teams. Give yourself an edge. Visit VSiN.com/subscribe. Get your football midseason special today. That's VSIN.com/subscribe. Should I be obnoxious here? Because I wrote like 12,000 words on the Mountain West, so you can preview that too. Just saying. There's other conferences out there, all right?
You ever thought going into sales?
Enough of this Midwest elitism. I just made up the term.
Midwest, right. Known for their elitism.
What?
Known for our elitism, the Midwest.
Nobody cares about Big Ten football. All right, college football, Southeastern Conference. See, everybody cares about the SEC. So let's talk. I think I'm going to go over this like a different way. And maybe, you know, we try to get through all these games, and now there's even more, of course, on the board in college football. Maybe go conference by conference. So we'll start in the SEC today. Go around. It's not a deep slate in the SEC. Auburn, Ole Miss. Let's start with this. So Auburn circa opens them up as a 6-point favorite on the road against Ole Miss with a total of 70.5. So this is kind of a twofold thing, right? Maybe the market's starting to move a little bit against Auburn after some disappointing results. Also maybe coming in here on Ole Miss after some impressive results early in the season. Of course, they did lose outright up to Arkansas. But the Tigers have failed to cover each of their last three games. They've lost two of them. They're now a 3-point favorite, and Bo Nix has been atrocious. We're talking about his last three games, 62 of 115, 5.5 yards per attempt, two touchdowns, four interceptions. He's been sacked nine times. He's adding nothing on the ground, averaging under 3 yards per carry, right, as an athlete, 2.97 exactly over this three-game slide. We talked about this actually when you remember after the Kentucky game at the start of the week or the start of the season, where they get the win, they ultimately cover, but it was a game in which Kentucky actually started to turn the ball over on downs late because they were going for it, trying to win that game, stay within it, and they get some short fields and they ultimately pull away. Even when you watch Auburn play, of course, when you watch Bo Nix play, there's no touch on the passes. It's go up and get it. Then he's fighting with Seth Williams on the sideline the last week too. It's just not a good situation here for Auburn. And it's clearly a team that had been overvalued, right? Because again, when you fail to cover three straight in the way that they have, probably should have lost to Arkansas as well. Right. It's a sense that the market has overvalued them. So now you have to ask yourself, is there a point where now you want to look at Auburn considering this open six and is now down to three against Ole Miss? And I think the initial thought would be, well, Ole Miss has been great. Why would you want to do that? But they are coming off of, right? And it was a really bad spot, but they are coming off of one of their worst performance, actually their worst performance this year, right? Ole Miss was in that terrible spot against Arkansas. Corral was awful. 20 to 38, 200 yards. That's 5.26 per attempt, two touchdowns. He threw six interceptions in that game. They still outgained Arkansas 442 yards to 394, but they averaged under 5 yards per play, 4.85. Does the terrible quarterback play continue going forward is a question here against Auburn. I have such a, I shouldn't say such a low opinion of Auburn, but in like the pecking order of the SEC, I have a low opinion of Auburn. This is a team that should never have been within the top 10, but we do this all the time with SEC teams in general. This is one I'd ultimately pass on. I can understand wanting to take six with Ole Miss initially, but now sitting at three when you've lost those 3 points of value off the opener at Circa, I would rather pass on this, but I do not want any piece of Auburn laying points on the road, given how poorly they have played and how well, when we have seen good Ole Miss, how well this Ole Miss offense has performed. Alabama and Tennessee, of course, also Alabama and Wes talked about this yesterday and on Sunday. When you see these initial line moves of some of these games, right? Certainly it's just betting a line because you know this is going to close much higher than the initial one. Alabama opens at circa 17 with a total of 66.5, now 21 against the Volunteers, likely to get a little bit higher by the time we reach Saturday. So reports are that the Volunteers might roll with two quarterbacks, but Guarantano is still going to be on the field. Won't give up on Guarantano just yet. Might be coming soon here, though, because Tennessee offensively has been hot trash the last two games. 287 total yards last week against Kentucky, 214 total yards against Georgia. In all, how about some of these numbers for Tennessee? Those last two games, 3.85 yards per play, 250.5 yards per game, a combined 7 of 29 on third downs, and they have committed 7 turnovers. What are they going to do in this spot against Alabama? And again, some of the pushback might be, well, Alabama might not be that good defensively. You sure about that? Because yes, Ole Miss was in a shootout with them, but they made adjustments in the second half against Georgia and completely shut down the Bulldogs, holding them again. Remember, we talked about that. Tim Murray getting that bet, 25.5 in terms of the team total for Georgia. After scoring 24 points in the first half, they didn't get over that total. And so while Alabama had trouble with Lane Kiffin's a really good offense, and we know how good this Ole Miss offense can be, I just don't know how bad this Tennessee offense has been. I don't know what they're going to do here against Alabama. I get it. Catching 21 at home seems like a favorable spot, and that could get even higher. But just from what we've seen from Tennessee and the initial rumblings that we might see two quarterbacks, to me that reeks of desperation a little bit when it comes to trying to fix your offense. And I don't want any part of that. So keep an eye on that number, though, as it continues to maybe climb throughout the week. Kentucky, Missouri. Kentucky has won its last two games. That defense is still damn good. We're talking about that they've allowed one touchdown in their last eight quarters of play against Mississippi State and Tennessee. They have forced 10 turnovers. They have given up 291 yards per game over this stretch, 3.4 yards per carry. They've allowed 3.36 per carry against Tennessee and Mississippi State their last two games. Now they're laying 5.5 with a total that opened at 49.5 here against Missouri. This is my issue with Kentucky and why I would be hesitant in terms of wanting to bet and lay points like this on the road. It's just Kentucky overall, the skill position, they've really struggled from an offensive standpoint. Like, they haven't been good. They're a one-dimensional team that can only run the ball, and that worries you against the Missouri front seven that I think is actually relatively decent, and we have seen it in flashes this year. But to me, it's just, yes, and we don't know how strong road home splits are this year and what home and field advantage is worth, But again, we're talking about going on the road, laying 5.5 with a one-dimensional offense that doesn't have much in terms of a passing attack. It's not a situation I would be comfortable in. And that's not something that I'll be looking to do this weekend with Kentucky. And then last but not least, LSU is 7-point favorite at home, total of 54.5 against South Carolina. I really don't know how good South Carolina is, but I do know that LSU defensively is not very good. Giving up 34 points to a putrid Mississippi State offense at the beginning of the year, looking like Mike Leach and KJ Costello were going to take the league by storm and then falling flat on their face. It's just not a good defense up to this point for LSU. Don't trust them. I wouldn't want any part of this, but not a strong opinion. South Carolina, LSU. No move off the open, though. Open 7, still sitting at 7 across operators. All right. Close out the show when we come back. A little bit of golf. Wes Reynolds is going to join us on the other side. We'll talk about the Zozo Championship coming up in California. See if Wes likes anybody. And whether or not the Long Shots host has some guys that he wants to stay away from or potentially fade in a field that's actually looking pretty stacked. You need Indeed. You instantly get a list of quality candidates from Indeed's resume database the moment you sponsor a job. Get started at Indeed.com/credit. All right. We got golf this weekend, too. Looks like a pretty good tournament. Let's bring in Wes Reynolds, host of Long Shots, of course, and many other things. Green Zone as well over the weekends, opening lines. He's here on Mondays to talk a little football with me here on the Edge. Wes, always appreciate it, bud. So Sherwood Country Club, Zozo Championship. Walk us through the course here, because it looks like not only a good field, but a really nice course to be playing on this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. 21 of the top 25 in this field this week in the official world golf rankings. And that's sans Dustin Johnson, who, of course, is a late scratch due to COVID, as he was last week. But a lot of good players this week. It's a Jack Nicklaus design, built in 89, minor makeover in 2016. Par 72, little over 7,000 yards. Actually, a different dynamic than we usually see on a par 72, because you got 5 par 5s, 5 par 3s, and then just 8 par 4s instead of the typical 10 on a par 72 design. But a good course. It hasn't had an official PGA Tour event, per se, but a lot of events have been played here over the years. The Old Shark Shootout, the World Challenge that Tiger Woods used to host was here from 2000 to 2013. So it is a well-known course, even though it hasn't been part of an official PGA Tour event.
So when you list off the way the holes are set up and all the par fives and par threes and a few par fours, how is this course played in the past? Sounds like it would be a lower scoring event.
It will be a lower scoring event. I don't know if it's going to get like mid 20 under par, but if you look kind of at, some of the previous events in Sherwood in the World Challenge history, high teens, low 20s, really not a long course. So it's not necessarily a course that you got to overpower necessarily. Because if you look at the previous winners back at the old World Challenge here at Sherwood, you see a lot of the shorter hitters that are good ball strikers, guys like Zach Johnson, Graham McDowell, Jim Furyk, Luke Donald. Those are also guys that have played well over the years at the RBC Heritage, which is not a Nicklaus design at Harbortown, but a little bit of similarity and corollary. So a few of the guys that have gone well there, I've gone with this week. And then, of course, there's old Tiger Woods, who has won this event 5 times and finished second 5 times in like a 13-year history. So obviously, that's why he's a little bit shorter than he'd normally be, defending champion from this Zozo event that was in Japan. So he is about 33-1 this week.
So you mentioned it, not exactly like you don't exactly need to be a long hitter here. So what kind of a golfer are you looking for? Just a statistical profile then?
Yeah, looking for the greens in regulation and guys that are essentially solid ball strikers. That's pretty much kind of the pattern here. And that led me to a couple guys. First guy I'll say is just because I was on him last week. It was a near miss. It was a runner-up for both myself and Matt Humans. I got to go with X-Man again, even though he's only 11-1. Three straight top fives in his last three starts. He's made 92.6% of his putts between 4 and 8 feet over the last three starts. And basically, he lost last week out here at Shadow Creek because he just didn't hit enough fairways. He hits a couple more fairways, he probably gets the win. But the guy that I thought really fit in terms of the profile was Webb Simpson. And he's anywhere in the high teens from about 20-1 right now. Six top 20s and three top 10s over the last seven starts. Has experience on this course because he did play Sherwood back in the old World Challenge days. And also was the winner earlier this summer at RBC Heritage. And I kind of mentioned that corollary just a couple minutes ago. Jim Furyk, Graham McDowell, Davis Love III, Luke Donald, Zach Johnson, all guys that have either at least been winners or runner-ups in the RBC Heritage, and it's also one here at Sherwood. And then a little bit down the board, Matt Fitzpatrick, I think, really fits this place at about 40-45-1. Putter didn't fire last week. That's his best club in the bag usually, but he was seventh in strokes gained approach. This is the type of course where a little bit of power off the tee can be somewhat negated. So it favors guys that are good ball strikers and good putters like Fitzpatrick. And also, looking at the correlation, I mentioned Nicklaus was the designer. So you want to look maybe at some of these Nicklaus designs, especially Muirfield Village in Columbus, where the Memorial is played. And he was third there earlier this summer in what were really tough conditions, which they're not going to get too many tough weather conditions here this week. So those were the type of players I was looking at.
I think I was reading this when I was doing some previewing on this. Does Matthew Wolf have an extensive history here, at least when he was playing like as an amateur in high school or something?
Yeah, he has played here, but you look, and this could be boom or bust because I've seen a lot of people like him this week. And the course experience, I think, has to be taken into account. But if you look at the winners here and the traditional profile of kind of the players I just mentioned, he is the exact opposite of that because he's big off the tee and his putter can be a little shaky and very much hit or miss. It was very good at the Shriners where he got into the playoff. And then for a long time last week at the CJ Cup, he was dead last. I think he ended up finishing 70th out of 78 players. So, you know, he's kind of a boomer bust. I mean, he's talented enough where he can win anywhere, but he wasn't like the ideal profile when I looked at for players and different statistics that really fit this place.
Wes Reynolds with us discussing what's going to go down this weekend, California, the Zozo Championship. Any sort of golfer or any specific golfers that you would potentially stay away from this weekend, Wes?
Yeah, just kind of looking over the field here. Some of these guys maybe that have done a little bit of travel, I think you could stay away from. A lot of people like Tyrrell Hatton for this week because he was first over at the BMW PGA and then was third last week at the CJ Cup. But now your third week after you made the cross-country travel, maybe I'm not as keen on him as maybe some other guys from a form standpoint. Tiger, look, the history, he could go very well here, but gosh, I don't want him at 33-1 in this form, even though he's practically owned this place. And he was the host of the World Challenge, which was held here from 2000 to 2013. So Tiger's a guy maybe looking to stay away from as well. Ricky Fowler also has decent history here, but he's been going through these swing changes and he's really struggled with the approach game. Putter is still very solid. He actually putted very solid at the Shriners, but just the approach game, I think he was dead last at the Shriners 2 weeks ago for strokes gained approach. And that's why he ended up missing the cut, despite the fact that he had a good round on Thursday. So those are guys I'm looking to stay away from. Phil Mickelson, look, he won last week on the Champions Tour at the Dominion at 5-2. So, look, he's going to win those events because Phil Mickelson, even at 50 years old, is longer than pretty much everybody on that tour. So when you're driving at 40, 50-yard path, guys, you know, you're going to win those tournaments on the Champions Tour. But not for me this week, even though he is off a win.
You play matchups in tournaments like this?
I do. Sometimes they come out late, so I can't get them in point spread weekly for the deadline, which is here in about 5 or 10 minutes. But Yeah, I do look at matchups a little bit. One I looked at, and another guy I played on the futures board. I did play Daniel Berger at 40-1, who he was the real hot man right when they restarted the tour in June when he won at Colonial and then nearly went back-to-back and finished third at the Heritage. And I mentioned that the RBC Heritage could be a decent corollary here at Sherwood. Could be a good spot for him. We know that Berger, because the field got cut off for the Masters for November because he won the Colonial immediately after that, he's still not in the field at the Masters, and they can invite him if they want, but he can't really qualify for the November Masters, so he can just focus on going out and winning golf tournaments, and I think this could be a good spot for him. I did go with him against Harris English, and then one more guy if he's looking to play, Joaquin Niemann, six last week at the CJ Cup, was also in contention, top five earlier this summer at the RBC Heritage. He has really been kind of coming along. This guy's still a very young player, and at 50-1, I think he's a decent price. The bomb I would look at triple digits is Kevin Na, who disappointed in the two home game appearances here in Las Vegas, where he lives out in Southern Highlands, but you can buy on the drift here. Good on Nicholas Designs, was a runner-up at Memorial a couple years ago and then was ninth earlier this summer. Also good at the RBC Heritage, where he's got five top tens in that event. So I think this Sherwood course is going to be more his speed, more than the two local courses he played this week at TPC Summerlin and Shadow Creek.
Wes Reynolds, host of the Green Zone. That's over at Mandalay Bay. And again, opening lines on Sunday nights with myself and Mondays here on The Edge. Wes, thank you very much, man.
All right, man. Thanks for having me, JBT. Yep,
you got it. Again, follow him on Twitter at WesReynolds1. All right, those are for the show today. We can go out early, right? We're all done. We're good to go? No. just to recap, too, some of the stuff we were talking about today. So, again, the news of the day is that Tua Tagovailoa does take over as the Miami Dolphins starting quarterback. And he will, of course, have a bye week to get ready for the Los Angeles Rams. Off for the week are the Miami Dolphins, a team that is in the top 11 in terms of overall team efficiency, sixth best team in terms of overall efficiency in the AFC, and the best team in the AFC East right now in terms of overall efficiency, have made the switch at quarterback. I think generally it's going to be a positive move here for Tua Tagovailoa and the Miami Dolphins. But at the same time, in a division in which you were 7-1 to win and a game back of the Buffalo Bills, who you lost to earlier in the year, a really weird move in terms of the timing. You see the updated odds there. Bills minus 200, Patriots 225. Both teams, by the way, coming off of consecutive losses. Dolphins coming off wins at three out of their four games and consecutive wins, 7-1. Jets at 500-1. I wanted to come in today, make the case that the Dolphins were very live to win that division. I think they are still live, but I don't think there's a doubt that their chances take a hit with a relative unknown at quarterback in Tua Tagovailoa. I still think this team's going to be very good, but it's a weird time to make the switch at quarterback considering how well the Dolphins had played and how poorly the teams around them had played in the AFC East. But with that, we are all done. Chris Andrews was great with us earlier today in the first hour. Actually gave you some of the numbers in terms of the difference potentially between Ryan Fitzpatrick and Tua Tagovailoa. Just got done with Wes previewing the golf tournament this coming weekend. A lot of analysis, too, on the first five games of the rotation for the NFL and in the SEC in college football. Make sure you stick around. I am more than certain that Betting Across America will have plenty of analysis on the switch to Tua Tagovailoa and much more here on VSiN, the Sports Betting Network. We'll see you.